All right, we are going to go ahead and get started. We are the Women in the Economy Commission on Tuesday, December 6th. And, welcome to everyone. We have a few people who are absent today and excused. My co-chair, Rebecca Chavez, is out of town. We'd like to excuse her. And we have an important discussion that's going to be happening as part of our agenda items later in our program, but we will begin first of all with an approval of the minutes from our last meeting. A motion on that. Commissioner Burkholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a correction to the minutes. The meetings will be taking place on the first Tuesday of the month starting in 2017. So we could make that correction to the Thursday of the month.
Thank you for that catch. Yes, it is Tuesday. Thank you very much. Commissioner Wallace.
I'd like to motion to approve the minutes for that change.
With that change. Thank you. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. The minutes are approved. We will begin with Stephanie Fisher and a presentation on FMLA eligibility potential legislation. And Stephanie, as we all know, is with the Ecology Coalition. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you so much for having me again. I presented in front of this group a little while ago about the environmental effort. But we also wanted to make you aware of a couple other pieces of legislation that our group is working on, and expert support and any feedback or guidance you may have for us as we work to introduce this to the legislature. So I just passed around a handout on FMLA. And as a little bit of background before I get started, FMLA is a federal law which provides up to 3 months of family or medical leave, up to 3 months of unpaid job-protected leave for certain family and medical conditions. To qualify under the federal law, you have to work for an employer who employs 50 or more employees. If you work for an employer that employs below that threshold, you are qualified under the federal law. There are a couple other qualifications. You have to work for a year. You have to work for 30 more hours. And then the type of leave that is covered is for either yourself, for your own medical emergency, for a child, for a spouse, or for a parent. So that's kind of what FMLA does, and what we see is that because of the way that the federal law is written, and particularly that 50 employee threshold, 40% of the workforce is not unqualified for unpaid leave. And so this is an issue that our group has been looking at and researching what's been done in other states and the different types of approaches and how we can look at expanding that here in Utah to increase the amount of individuals that are protected under that law. So this session, we will be introducing a bill, and it's being sponsored by Representative Fisher and Senator Shizawa to lower that employee threshold to 30 employees, and that captures the larger you'll see in the facts that I handed around that most people don't take much leave at all. 40% of the workforce takes just 10 days or less, and 70% of the workforce takes 40 days or less. So most people, like I said, don't need a lot of leave, but there are no legal protections in place for those types of employees to ensure that they can take the minimum amount of time to family medical issues. So that's the bill that will be introduced this session. We're just sending the language over to the drafting attorney this week, and we anticipate it will start in the House and then we can carry over to the Senate on other issues all to get that far. So that's kind of an overview of that bill.
Stephanie, I just have a question about the number of people that are, do you think this is going to capture, going from 50 to 30?
I think it'll be around 7% additionally. We've got some data on that, and there's a small percentage. But something we'll check and verify, and mm-hmm. yeah, we'll be on this legislation?
My question is just general questions about FMLA, so that I understand. So right now with 15 employees, is that full-time FTE or is that including part-time as well?
30 hours or more.
30 hours or more, okay. And my other question was, is this in addition to paid leave time, or if they're using paid leave time, then they won't be able to use unpaid FML-eligible time, if that makes sense?
Right, so it's really up to the employer, but it can run concurrently. So if the employer provides, say, 4 weeks of paid leave, then you would count those 4 weeks as part of it as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. And like I said, we have your support, and any feedback you have for us, we're considering.
We have another question from Commissioner Gomez.
Go ahead. A couple questions. Do you have a sponsor in the house? You said you started in the house.
Representative Pitcher.
Pitcher, okay. And so the only big change from current federal FMLA regulations would be the reduction to a 30 employee rate. There's no other changes to it.
No. Okay.
And what do you anticipate the employer's pushback will be on this? Because I anticipate you will receive some small business pushback. Would they claim that it's an additional cost to them, that they're not a big enough organization where they can't cover workload as they adhere to this? Like, what have you heard might be some pushback from employers?
Yeah, I think you're on to the right idea. We anticipate that some employers may feel that it's just a burden to do the assigned work when they hire someone in to cover the workload while the employee's off. And we are open to doing some type of tier D. And I guess we're kind of waiting to maybe gauge the response from what the city is. We're open to doing maybe some kind of tier D where if you've got between 30 and 40 employees, it could be maybe 4 or 6 weeks of the week, and then between 40 and 50, maybe 6 or 8 weeks. So that's certainly a possibility that we'd be willing to look at.
Okay. And do you know if any other states have done something similar?
Yes. 16 states, I'm sorry. And the majority of them have actually taken the threshold much lower. Some states have gone down to 5 or 10. Some states have gone to 25. So we feel that 30 is a pretty reasonable middle-of-the-road solution.
And do they have any data showing any positive or negative effects of the implementation of this?
I don't know about the states that have lowered the employee threshold even more.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great idea, and we'll look into that. But we do have data from the Department of Labor surveying employers that already comply with FMLA. And it's one that actually, I didn't say one for myself, but it's an overwhelming number of employers say that complying with FMLA is easy and that it has had either a positive or a neutral impact on their business. I apologize, I can't quote those numbers back to you, but you've got it in front of you. We're kind of relying on that data to show that FMLA is fairly easy to comply with. But that's an excellent idea to look at the streets and see what additional impact it's had.
Yeah, just thinking of you presenting before a standing committee, I would assume it would be helpful if you could have some supporting data to show the positive effects that have been shown in other states.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Commissioner Henderson?
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. We had a conversation, and you answered some of my questions. I was wondering if we talked about maybe doing a tiered system or a big bite of the apple may be too much to swallow for our state, right, all at once. I would encourage you to get together with the business community and maybe there will be some negotiations we'll ensue. I am sympathetic to both sides here because I can see the need there, but I can also see how a small business would be difficult to not fill someone's position for 3 whole months. That could be very difficult. So I appreciate it willing to negotiate that down and having some statistics on the impact. The real impact on other businesses from other states that have done this would be, I think, incredibly helpful. I think you're going to experience a lot of pushback, to be quite honest. I'd be surprised if it got out of committee as it is. So sometimes baby steps are better than no steps. Just going to put that out there.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Barnett has something to say, but her button doesn't work. So I'm advocating for her.
Thank you.
Thank you. cover myself. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for coming. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's job protection, but it's not your job position. So they can protect your job if you, you know, they can put someone else. Okay. Isn't that right? It's not your position.
So once you return, they do need to return you to either the same position or a slightly empty position.
And is that written? Is that written?
That's in federal law. Yeah, so you can't come back and it effectively be demoted or return to the position that has either lesser responsibilities, obviously lesser pay would be prohibited. So you're correct that it doesn't have to be the same position, but it needs to be substantial.
The same pay. They can't lower your pay? Is there anything in the business?
That's correct. They can't lower your pay unless the business, and this is all federal law, but they can do it if the business were undergoing some type of reduction anyway, and the employees leave have nothing to do with that type of reduction. So there are certain instances where, yes, this is a natural reducing, or, you know, sometimes businesses undergo big changes, then that's, you know, permissible under the federal law.
So what my understanding is you're going in for a state law that says you're going to lower it to 30.
Correct.
And there's no other language that you're going to put in there. It's just the 30, nothing more.
That's correct. Initially, we did look at codifying some of the FMLA provisions into state laws to provide additional security.
Mm-hmm.
But we feel that it may be a little too much. And, you know, essentially the impact would be the same to just address that inquiry threshold. So,
you know, at will state is very, yes, very challenging, I agree. Very, very challenging. Thank you for going forward with it, though.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for your feedback.
I mean, if you don't do it, they can't say no.
Well, and we felt that, you know, the resulting conversation around these issues is important. It's good to be talking about these and creative ways that we can address this, even if we don't get very part of the session. It's an important conversation. And if it's okay, Representative, we do have a couple other bills that I wonder if I could briefly introduce.
That'd be great.
Thank you. So another issue, I'll be brief, but we're looking at a bill that would, let me provide a little background. Earlier this year, there was a bill that was passed in Congress which requires that all federal buildings now have baby changing stations implemented. We're looking at doing something similar here in Utah. There's actually a fabulous little provision in the state building code, which I was made aware of a couple months ago, which states that if a baby changing station is implemented in any business, then it must be equally accessible to men and women. So we're really, you know, excited to see that. I'm not sure how compliant the committee are, but nonetheless, it's a welcome provision in Utah law. So we'd like to take that just one step further and say that all new government buildings going forward that are being constructed should have baby changing stations in them if they are open to the public. That will be sponsored by Representative Hemingway. And then we're working with an individual, an individual named Leslie, who has a bill through Representative Chavez Houck, which addresses billing schemes and potential for alternative billing under Utah law. Specifically, she's been looking at medical billing as well as school fees and things like that. But when we've got a divorce decree, which states that each parent is responsible for a specific portion of the bill, what she has found is that sometimes these billing companies will bill her for the total. She has tried to then send her ex-husband's portion back on them, but they don't have the mechanism for separating that bill until eventually she's taken the collection and she doesn't pay her portion. So the idea here is to ask that businesses and billing companies do separate those two portions and just comply with the court order so that the burden does not fall on the compliant party. So I believe that is going to be an issue moving forward as well. And then we have been looking at some potential equal pay provisions, and I don't know if you want to briefly talk about that.
Good morning. Thanks. My name is Aaron Jefferson. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the YWCA Utah. And we are
concerned about pay equity issues. This is a priority policy issue that has come to our attention when surveying our members across the state, as well as through some policy conversations that we've been convening as part of our Utah Women's Wellbeing Initiative. This, in terms of larger issues around economic well-being for women, this has risen to the top around as something that we need to address here in the state of Utah. So this year, we are trying to get a sense of some efforts that are maybe already in the works. So I know Representative Wheatley ran a bill last session, and we hear that he is planning on doing that again this session around pay transparency. And so at this point, we're really just trying to get a sense of what might be coming down the pike and how we might be able to either support those efforts or provide input if we feel like there's improvements that could be made on that potential legislation. And then there are some other potential cleanup issues that I know the Utah Women's Coalition is looking at and that we'd be happy to partner with in terms of are there ways that we can make sure that all forms of compensation are addressed in our wage discrimination statute? We don't know if that's something that will go forward this session or not, but just wanted to make you all aware that pay equity is something that is important to us and that we're definitely working with the coalition on best ways to address that, which we recognize are not always just legislative. So these are complex issues, and I know there's a lot of efforts going on in the state around STEM education and encouraging and promoting women in non-traditional work fields, and I think those are all really important efforts and to kind of partner with legislative work to start to reach pay parity. So,
I think that's a question here. Useful. Okay, Commissioner Bowman.
A quick question on the BD chain communication. You said that the bill would require newly constructed state buildings or all current existing and newly constructed state buildings?
All new buildings as well as buildings going under a renovation.
Oh, okay. So something that's going to be touched construction-wise is going to be required. Okay,
correct.
So we met last week as a policy subcommittee and had some of these discussions. So this is great. It's like you're getting our policy subcommittee. No, it's perfect. But adding on what you said, what you're talking about with the wage transparency, did we discuss separating out the wage and the benefits on the Right to Know website? That was one of the, when we talk about other things, other ways we can kind of be more transparent and get a better handle on, if there is, to what extent there is some kind of wage gap. That was one of the things we discussed, right?
Yes, that's correct. It's not an issue we'll be moving on this session, just partially because we're out of time and we have other priorities, but definitely something we'd like to look at moving forward is understanding a little bit better the Utah Right to Know website. My understanding is it's run through the Salt Lake Tribune, but maybe knows more than that. But separating that so that you have a clearer picture of what the salaries are, because right now when it's all together, it's just not going to be a very clear picture.
Thank you. So maybe instead of worrying about the Right to Know website, which we don't control, we do control the transparency website. And that's the one where people are mandated by state law, every government entity from public hospitals to universities are required to put their expenses, their revenues, and their staff salaries on this website. And I think that our Department of Finance, who oversees this, is more able to, go in and make sure that that's up to date. So I know that that's something, I'm on the transparency board, and I know that that's something that we have talked about, trying to make sure that these are separated out more so that it is more transparent, So I can actually just look into that. I don't know if that's something that would require a statutory change.
Right.
It might, but I'll talk to John Rehat, the division director, the division of finance, who oversees all of this, and find out, because I think that's an important.
That would
important relationship to make.
What's the website for that transparency?
Transparentmedicine.gov.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Well, maybe our next meeting is in February, so maybe by then we can have sort of an answer on that. That's helpful to know.
Okay.
Then, if you can.
Are there any other questions for Stephanie or Anna?
Thank you very much. All right. Next item. Kathy, are you walking through this contract?
I can do whatever you want.
Okay. Why don't we turn the time over to you for kind of a review of the contract proposal. We can do that. So.
Okay. So, as you know, we were appropriated $25,000 for the last general session, and we voted as a commission to use that money to contract with the Utah Valley University to hire a research fellow to assist Susan Madsen in researching the issue of the educational attainment of women in Utah. And so this last month, we've gone back and forth with UVU to create this contract. Basically, it shows how the money's going to be dispersed. There's going to be four phases of the research project. They'll get reimbursed after they finish each phase of the project. We have a provision in here that allows us to stop payment if the services are going past into the next fiscal year, because our appropriation was not non-lapsing funds, meaning at the end of the next state fiscal year, they're going to go back to the general fund. So we put in a provision here that any services provided after that will be paid contingent on us getting non-lapsing authority this next mayoral session. I don't anticipate any issues with us getting that authority, but DWS staff will work on making sure we get that just in case. But if we don't, we have a provision here that protects us from having to pay should that happen. We are giving them until December 1st, 2017 for a final report. We're not anticipating it'll take that long, but we just wanted to give the contract at least a year's time so they have enough leeway to produce a good product. We go through the ownership rights as well. Oh, this isn't the full contract. Shelley, whoever has a hard copy, it's not the, it doesn't have the attachment. So before. Did you send it out electronically?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the electronic version that you received has the scope of work. And I should look it up. But basically, it's going through those phases, what the elements of the research are that they need to complete, and as well as the ownership rights portion. That was the portion that was the most negotiated between us and UVU. Concern over who actually owns the data and the report when it's all finished. Luckily, we were able to come out on top on that one, so they are agreeing to allow us to own the data and the report. They have asked to... yes, thank you. And this one's my favorite. So what we agreed to is allow them to publish the report after the Women in the Economy Commission has published the report. They can do it on their website. Susan Madsen has said that she has lots of speaking engagements and that she will be speaking about this research and giving credit to Women in the Economy Commission as she speaks about it, and ensure that we were getting credit for the product that we're paying for and helping produce. They will also have their name and logo on the report below our name and logo. So those are some of the terms that we worked out so that we could all move forward. And then just so I can run down the responsibilities of UVU that we've agreed to. So they're going to look at the following research questions. What is the educational attainment of women in Utah? They're going to look at the major program, institution, county, region, and also statewide. They're going to compare this to U.S. attainment levels. They're going to look at how this has changed throughout time and across generations. They're going to look at what's the higher education context in Utah, how many adults by gender have technical, associate, bachelor, graduate, and professional certificates and degrees. They're going to look at what the pipeline was leading into that attainment of education, so high school to college, Utah schools and universities, and then they're going to look at how to explain and reconcile different results that arise from various data resources. They're going to be using UC data, Utah System of Higher Education, Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, and U.S. Census data, as well as American Community Service data. And they, and it's not finite. They can add other data sets if they find it reasonable. So the benchmarks are March 2017, then June 2017, September, and then final report December 1st. That's basically it.
Any questions on that? I know that that's been a journey to get to this point, and co-chairs and Kathy and Susan Manson and all and Jenny Robinson, all folks who are involved in this project, I think we're finally at a resolution and we can move forward and look forward to some exciting data that's going to be coming. So if we don't have any conversation on this, other questions? Commissioner Henderson?
Hi.
Thank you. This is good. I'm really excited about that. But I'm just going to go back to the other item we were talking about just a second ago. Sorry. Because I just was looking it up, and the transparency website, transparency.utah.gov, has everything, benefits, salary, paid leave, bonuses, all of that is already in place, and you can look by employee name. There will be some certain circumstances where the employee name is redacted, but for the most part, unless there are extenuating reasons, you can tell who it is, and it bifurcates everything. So
that, now I know
better than doing all afternoon.
Yep.
On transparency, that you saw that, though.
You'll have to try that one again.
Better than having
kept your dumb coffee.
Thank you, Senator Henderson.
My button.
Commissioner Barnett, you're on.
Thank you. I don't have a copy of everything you just read, so I'm just going to ask a question, and if it's already in there, then because my buttons don't work today. Is there any data on non-traditional employment? Is there any data on that? Because I know you...
I don't know if there exists data on that. We haven't listed it as a data set that they're going to use. That doesn't necessarily mean...
Because you're going, to... higher education and all of that, but that's not the only way to get education.
Commissioner Barnett, that's a helpful point to just keep that in our minds, and I'll just look here on the UVU responsibilities on 1D, where it says, what is the higher education context in Utah? How many adults by gender have a technical associate, bachelor, and grad? So it does list that. Is that
technical? It's not your non-traditional, like women in the trades.
Tell me a little bit more about that then.
Well, I'm just thinking how they is it they're going from what the data is to
get a sense of where they're getting their education. This is what the data. This is what this is about.
Educational attainment, and then I think looking at the job that they did attain. When you're saying that's not a traditional, how would you categorize women in the trade?
Non-traditional, where they go through a 5-year apprenticeship program.
So apprenticeship program. So we maybe added that language, and have them look at that data set as well.
Okay.
And do you know a data set that's in existence that captures that?
I check that out for you.
Okay.
Let me check that out. I'm not sure they have it. It's at JTPOs.
Oh, okay.
Joint Training Apprenticeship. I'm sure they do.
Okay.
Yeah. And I know they have it broken out to gender because they have to report on that. And then getting grants and such.
Yeah. That's helpful to know because I think sometimes when we see the word technical, we're assuming that is the umbrella, and what you're saying is we're missing a subsection there. Yeah.
Whether it be women in trade, UCAT, SWIC, any of those, but still, that's quite an education for 5 years. Thank you.
Can we just include that, Kathy?
If you tell me to include it, I will include it.
I think that's an important inclusion.
Burt Holder. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a number of questions about the agreement in terms of the negotiation with UBU. Any unusual or controversial provisions in the agreement and the ownership rights section, and I think that you've answered all of those questions. I do suggest that we consider in the copyright statement saying Utah Women in the Economy Commission rather than simply Women in the Economy Commission as a way to clarify this, because if the data are going outside the state and that's the only statement, we may want to be sure that leaders understand that it's coming from the Utah Commission. Just something to consider.
Okay, you can make that addition as well. Any other thoughts? This is helpful to have all these sets of eyes on this, even after we feel like we've seen this a million times. It just makes things. Anything else? Just as a reminder, Shelly sent this out as and one of the attachments yesterday in her email at 9:58. So if you want to go back and look at it more carefully. But if we have no further discussion, then let's look at a motion for approval of this resolution. We have a motion for an approval of the contract proposal.
I move that we approve the interagency agreement between Utah Department of Workforce Services and Utah Valley University for the Women in the Economy Research Project.
For the Utah Women in the Economy Research Project.
For the Women in the Economy Research Project.
Yeah, Scott. Here we go. All right. Seeing no discussion to that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great, that passes unanimously. Thank you again for all of the effort that went into that. That would be great to get that going. Next item of business is the resolution concerning electronic meetings. And this became an issue when we were faced with a time crunch on the past issue. And realizing that time was of the essence to hire this individual who's going to be conducting and starting on the research, and that we did not have a mechanism to make that assignment, that approval, without getting together, and that we needed to have formalized our mechanism for conducting electronic meetings. And so that's what this is. You have a copy of this in front of you, and it's simply a resolution that we approve a process for conducting electronic meetings, and you can see that as per state code, all public bodies are required to adopt a resolution, rule, or ordinance governing the use of electronic meetings. And as we read through this, we resolve that anytime we're holding a meeting in which one or more of our Women in the Economy Commission members would like to participate, that they may participate electronically, provided that the notice and procedures of the meeting conform to Open Public Meetings Act, as referenced in the Utah Code above, that they don't need to be physically present, but they can be connected to the anchor location, which would be this room in this, most of the cases, and that they could be connected through some kind of computer, telecommunications, telephonic device, provided that the chairs or the administrative assistant, thank you, Shelley, at the appointment time would, and this probably means Shelley is going to initiate this contact, so that they be connected up and we'd initiate that conversation so they could listen in. And then the other procedures are that they would need to notify the chairs and the administrative assistant at least 24 hours before the meeting so we could get things organized, and that the notice of the meeting shall note that the meeting was conducted electronically, the minutes of the meeting rather, and the administrative assistant would also note
the identity of those individual members who participated electronically, that those who are participating electronically should be able to hear and speak with each other and all individuals present at the Inca location, that electronic participation in the meeting shall constitute presence at that meeting for all purposes, including the determination of a quorum and voting, and that if there were any handouts or visuals like this flyer that Stephanie handed out earlier, that those would be provided electronically if that is, we make a reasonable effort there, and that the electronic participation would only apply to Women in the Economy Commission members and Department of Workforce Services folks. So that basically runs through what the resolution says. Is there any discussion to that resolution? Okay. Seeing none, do we have a motion to approve this resolution? All of your lights are already on, so I can't tell if someone's willing or not. Okay, Commissioner Burkholder.
I move approval of the resolution concerning electronic meetings.
Great. Any discussion to that motion for approval? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, we have ourselves an electronic meeting resolution. That's great. That's very nice to have that. We're going to move on to our subcommittee updates. And let's see. We'll start with the policy subcommittee because I feel like we basically just had that. Thank you to bring up these notes here if I have any additional things from our meeting. Let's see, we talked about Senator Escamilla's bill, Mark Wheatley's bill on wage discussion. And Senator Henderson, do you have, in our meeting there was discussion about proposed legislation says not confirmed to look at the definition of discrimination to include benefit package numbers. Do you have?
I can address that with
nothing. Thank you, Stephanie.
I have reached out to Senator Henderson. However, moving forward, we think that maybe it might be better to include our small amendment in the representative meeting too, since he's addressing the same question. I don't know if Senator has any thoughts on that. I know we haven't had an opportunity to touch base, but it might be a logical solution to move forward.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be great. Kill two birds with one stone. Is his bill going to pass? So it may be worth it to have a separate bill drafted that can pass. If this is something that is important to do, then it might be good. Yeah, it would be great to put it in there, but if it's not going to pass, it's not going to help you much.
Okay. I mean, the other option would be the significant section of the bill get amended out in a very small amendment passed, but it seems like probably.
And that might be a very good strategy. I mean, maybe. That particular bill, that was Senator Iwamoto's bill, and it passed the Senate. There were a few no's, but it passed the Senate really well. It passed the House, too. I don't know why they amended that provision out of it, it seems non-controversial enough, except for a few people, but I would think that could be overcome. So, I don't know. I'll work with you on it if you want to put it in his bill and see what we can do that way, that's fine.
Okay.
Our strategy, I guess.
I think so. Our group is actually meeting this afternoon at 12, so we'll have a conversation amongst ourselves, and then maybe I'll get in touch with you afterwards after we figure out how we'd like to proceed. That.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. I think it's always important to know where we are with what's possible and strategy. These things are important to know. The other thing that we've discussed, and Matthew, I see you in the back there, and I don't want to put you on the hot seat, but we did discuss earned income tax credit, and I don't know if you want to come up and speak to that issue. This was just, we know the Voices for Utah Children is looking at that, and she wants to tell us sort of where you are.
Okay, so Matthew Weinstein, Voices for Utah Children. We had considerable conversation during the interim on this. At the September interim day, a leading national scholar on this issue, Dr. Michael Strain from the American Enterprise Institute, came to town and addressed several committees on interim day about this issue. And that certainly helped move the conversation forward. Representative John Westwood has put in a bill drafting request as one of his three priority bills. We've also been in conversation with the Tax Commission to address their concerns about refundable tax credits in general and the potential for abuse that exists with those, and is there ways of addressing that. And they're having some conversations with DWS about how this could be targeted to the intergenerational poverty population in particular. And if there's the potential for data exchange that would make that possible, which would fit in well, of course, with Utah's ongoing strategy of addressing intergenerational poverty and identifying sort of cutting-edge solutions to do that. And so whether an earned income tax credit could be a means of doing that. And we're also in conversation with a number of senators about the potential for having a Senate sponsor as well. So that's where things stand right now, but we are cautiously optimistic about having legislation in the coming session on the earned income tax credit.
Can you just give us, thank you very much for stepping in here and giving us a little review on where you are. Could you help us remember, Representative Hutchings has run this legislation in the past, and what happened there?
That was in 2013 and 2014. It passed the House both years, never made it to a floor vote in the Senate. I think the main concerns were the fiscal vote. It was a $25 million fiscal impact. The proposal that we're putting in this year, I expect, will be about a fifth of this because of the discussions that we're having about elements that could be refundable versus non-refundable. And we're certainly interested in hearing feedback from the members of the commission, as well as from members of the Senate and the House about the specifics on that.
Yeah. A couple of questions. Mr. Gomez.
What is the rate of people who are taking advantage of federal earned income tax credit in Utah?
It's 18% of filers, so it's about 200,000 households.
Okay.
I think the average that they get is, it's around $2,500, $3,000, something in that range. I don't know the numbers in front of me. And it's estimated that about 77, I think the last number that I saw was about 77% of those who are eligible file for it, which means that it doesn't reach, everyone who's eligible. But it does have a substantial impact. Most people are only in it for 3 years. It's sort of where people cycle out of it because it's given them the boost that they need to get beyond just sort of the being the working poor and getting more into the slum, working class and middle class.
Do you think it could be beneficial to maybe invest further in educating those who aren't availing themselves of the federal earned income tax credit prior to introducing the state version, since there's 23% of individuals who would fall within the eligibility range that aren't taking the benefit of it?
That's a sort of a judgment call. I don't know if there's data that shows, 26 states have created their own. Mm-hmm. In some ways, that can be combined with increased public outreach and public relations sort of advertising, sort of marketing of the tax credits so people know that it's there and they should file for it. The state does put some resources into that already. There's also some federal resources that go into that through the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance or FIDA program. And that certainly helps And any additional amounts certainly be opposed.
Commissioner Henderson.
Thank you.
So, and I know you've been working on this issue for a long time, and I've been kind of an obstacle in your path, and we'll just put that out there right now. So some of my concerns with this, and I see the benefit of it, I do, but I also have a lot of concerns. Can you tell us what percentage of the people who get paid the federal earned income tax credit are paid erroneously? What's the fraud percentage?
So the folks who look into this say that it's important to distinguish between fraud and erroneous payments. The erroneous payments rate is about a quarter at the federal level, about 25%. And they estimate, my sense from looking at it, is that about a third of that at the most is the actual fraud. That's why we're actually looking at what California did when they created theirs. They became the 26th state to create one of these last year. And they made self-employment income ineligible for their state UITC. Because the sense is that because that's not verified, and you have to actually do a full-scale audit and look at somebody's records and bank records and so forth to verify it, if you limit it as they did to W-2 income, which is employer-reported, there is withholding, then you cut out, my sense is, most of the concerns about fraud.
So the federal tax credit doesn't exclude the self-employed.
That's correct.
But the state could.
Yeah, exactly. And still, you get most of the benefit. I mean, most, I think it's, I don't know in front of it, it's around 80, I think it was 80% that goes through W-2 income, but it's that minority of it that's going to self-employment where there is the biggest concern about that because it's more difficult to verify. And so California really is something that we've looked at, we've been discussing with the Tax Commission, that we think would address most of that.
So another concern I have is the amount, the dollar amount is very small, right? It's like $300, $500 a year. What was it?
So if it was set at 5% and refundable, I think it's a maximum of a little over $300 per family per year.
So it's a small amount, which, you know, $300 for a family in need is helpful. I mean, there's no question that it's not life-changing. So my concern is that it's small. I know that that's not where you want to stop. You'd like it to be much, much bigger, right? And it all comes out of the education fund. And so, you know, these are all questions I think we really need to think about, you know, long-term, what is going to be beneficial to the children of the state of Utah. Is it $300 in their parents' pockets once a year, or is it trying to make sure that we keep the money in the education fund you know, staying secure and not take it out as, you know, as much as possible. We've had these discussions in writing tax over the last few years about tax credits and whatnot, and, you know, a broad-based system is better for education. It just is.
Well, I felt that the most powerful evidence that was presented by Dr. Strain from the American Enterprise Institute was comparing side-by-side the research that looked at when you put a given amount of money into, and the research looked at it, earned income tax credit versus interventions in the classroom, such as smaller class sizes and things like that, the earned income tax credit was 3 times as effective in terms of improving low-income students' educational outcomes. And that speaks to the...
A state earned income tax credit or the federal one? Because the federal one is significant.
This is
between
state and federal. And at the given amounts. I mean, let me get you the specific research that he was citing. But it speaks to the detrimental effect of economic instability on low-income families, kids' educational outcomes, and the fact that, you know, when they're moving around more, switching schools, parents aren't available to help them with their homework, that undermines their educational performance. Getting them to a point of economic stability has a big positive impact that can very well justify on the basis of educational outcomes for
them. So if I can just ask one more follow-up question. You said something that intrigued me about tying it to intergenerational poverty. Can we do that? Or is it something that if we do it, it has to be just across the board to everybody, or can it be tied to our intergenerational poverty families?
Well, that's what we're looking into. And certainly I have to defer to DWS. You asked for a great extent on this. But my understanding is that the data exchange between the Tax Commission and DWS is at least theoretically possible. And hopefully this will move the conversation forward and help us find out in practice.
Can I just ask this question and piggyback off of that? Because I think I heard you present an interim something similar to that, that DWS is actively engaged in contracting with data sharing with the Tax Commission, and we're not. So when you say this is the status of it and that's what's being worked on, can you describe that for me and what parties are involved? Because we're not actively engaged in contracting with the Tax Commission and sharing information.
No, and I didn't mean my comments.
Okay, I just want to be clear. I just want to understand what.
Well, I very much hope that this proposal might help to move those discussions forward, and so we can explore and see if that is possible.
Okay. Yeah, so, Senator Henderson, we haven't fully looked into that. I haven't reviewed the law to see whether or not it is possible for us to share the names of those who are considered to be intergenerational poverty, but I'm happy to look into it and let you know my perspective, and then, you know, if you want to contact us and the Tax Commission set up a meeting, we'll start discussing that. And of course, we'd be open to it. We're always looking for ways to help those who are experiencing that. So.
Great.
And then, can I ask another question? So you said that your original fiscal note on this proposal was $25 million. How are you scaling it back to the $5 million?
So if we say that it's only refundable for IGP families, that means a big reduction in fiscal. Because most of the value of the EITC is the refundable portion. And if we say that it's only refundable for the ICP families, that reduces the refundable population from 200,000 to something around 20%.
So the amount remains the same. I mean, it's the scale back of the number of people who would be impacted, not the amount that they would receive.
If I may make a comment there, and I like the idea, and I'm not a lawyer, clearly, but there may be a constitutional issue with not being, I guess, fair, and I can't think of the right word, but there is a provision in our tax code that talks about, you know, kind of parity between, you can't pick and choose one over another. It has to be, if it's for one group, it has to be for all of the group, basically. And I'm being very inartful at how I'm explaining this, so I'm going to have to look this up, but I wonder if there might be some kind of a constitutional prohibition against just picking intergenerational poverty people for this sort of thing. But maybe not, I don't know. So I'll look at it. I'll overlook it. Okay.
I will definitely defer to the lawyers on that one.
Well, good discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your effort on this. And to really all of you folks in the community who are advocates and working towards making a difference on these important issues, really appreciate all that you all are doing.
Thanks. So, thanks to the members of the commission for everything you're doing to move some of these issues forward.
Thank you. The last item that we talked about in our research subcommittee meeting, in our policy subcommittee meeting last week, was the premarital counseling bill that was run, I think it was last year, and they're looking at, the Utah Marriage Commission is looking at this again in 2017, and basically what this does is it increases the marriage license fee by $20 and then provides that $20 as a rebate back to couples who have received some type of premarital counseling or premarital education. And the bill lists the requirements for providers and as well as the requirements for premarital education for the programs, not specific curriculum, but the issues that they would be counseled on. So that was a bill I think the Representative Red ran last year, and their Utah Marriage Commission is looking at running again. So I think that's all we are arms around right now.
Commissioner Burkholder. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not a question about legislation that the committee might be looking at, but appropriations. And I wonder whether there's been any conversation about funding the telephone survey that is meant to succeed the focus groups in the research on women throughout the state and the economy that the research subcommittee is undertaking right now, those 14 focus groups. There was not receipt of Walmart funding for that project, so it's currently unfunded. So that second phase of their research, did the Public Policy Committee talk at all about trying to secure an additional appropriation, small appropriation this year to fund that research?
We did not discuss that, so that's something that's good. Heads up on that. Do you have any sense for what that, what type of numbers we're looking at there?
I don't think it was more than what was requested last year, so probably around $30,000, I would guess.
Okay. All right. I will talk to Co-Chair Chavez-Hout and see what we can do on that front to get that ball rolling. Thank you. Any other things that we're missing on policy? Okay. We may continue to hear things, and we're meeting in February. Of course, you remember that we're required to meet once during the legislative session, and I think that's on February 6th. I think that's our date for that, but we'll double check. I'll show you, just double check that as we get to the end of our agenda. But
February 7th.
Okay. And we don't have a room yet, but we will find a place. And if you need to participate electronically, maybe you can do that now. So it's a snowy day, and you can't come up here. Let's see. Research subcommittee. Anyone here who'd like to give a presentation on the research subcommittee? Okay, the meeting in January. The focus groups, they're off and running. They're out participating and getting folks to participate. And I know they're working on that. That's going. And the telephone follow-up piece, will see if we can get that funded. And maybe we just wait to hear from you in February then as to how that all went. And communications subcommittee, Commissioner Wallace. Thank you.
The subcommittee for communications did meet about a month ago, just after we submitted the final changes to the website. That's been a long time coming, a little bit too long. But we do have final changes that should have been made by Utah Interactive. I wasn't able to get onto Wi-Fi, so to double check it. But we changed just a little bit about the layout, but mostly about the content. Making sure that the messaging on the website was right, and really the mission and purpose of the commission is impacting policy. What the website continues to do and will do when it's launched is to share not only the mission of the commission, but also our suggestions for other organizations to do their part, although we aren't in charge of the other organizations. So it's to reach out to educational institutions as well as business organizations, individuals, themselves, and families, and government. One area that we discussed as a committee was religious organizations, and we could never come up with anything to tell them of what to do. And so we decided to drop that actually off of the website and just consider them with the organizations. So we won't even address and really make recommendations for religious organizations on the website. I don't know how you feel about that. We can go over that after the rest of what I want to share with you. Talking about money that we've had within the commission to use, we are grateful for Utah Interactive for really donating the time and resources to do this website for us. The logo was approved a handful of months ago by the commission, so that's something that we can utilize, not just on the website. Additionally, we also would like to meet with, our commission would like to meet with the subcommittee chairs of both policy and research. So we want to meet with all those subcommittee chairs so that we can work on messaging together. We do have a press release ready for when we do launch that. I'd love to launch it just before the legislative session, if not just the very beginning. Our human interest story in it has to do with the interior design work that was done on the bill last year. We can hear recommendations from you to that example, something that's current, and it's great to have a list of policy that is coming up. Let's see. Also, just as far as next steps, would be ongoing messaging and how we can be more involved with more exposure in our community. We have a website, we have commission members, and I know we've talked with the commission about attending events representing our commission as opposed to our general organizations or affiliations, and something that we could, as a committee, put together some events that might be good for us to be represented. And I also think that it might be a really good idea for us to keep, even if it's in-kind sponsorship, for some events that really support what we support, how we, our logo starts showing up in places. So that's the information I have so far, and the website, I believe it's ready, it just needs to be launched with a press release or a media advisory.
So the website is all ready to go, but for a push of a button at the designated date?
Yes. Okay. The final changes just have been made. I just wanted to double check. I wasn't able to, but we feel it's in a place where we can push and make it go live, and there's always going to be updates to it. One thing that we did want to make into a phase two was a spotlight of Utah women that have advanced or show as a, an example, a living example of women being elevated the way we want them to be. So we felt like that we didn't want to wait on the website launch in order to have a bank of those stories that we can work on them as a step to our phase two.
So is there a date or a specific event you're looking to tie this rollout to in January?
Well, if we have legislation that matches up with it as an example of what our commission is really pushing for, it would depend on if there's a best date for that. I have no idea what that would be, whether it would be as a leading into it or if it's just about to come up to a committee or a board. We would take recommendations probably from the policy committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's something maybe we could have a meeting that you're talking about at the beginning of January and kind of know the landscape a little bit better in terms of when would be a good time to do that for maximum, PR, whatever, impact. Would that be?
I think that's a wonderful idea. I'll send you some times that would work. I also wanted to mention that we've lost a few of the committee members we had. Just in gym position, they don't have the bandwidth to serve. And so if you do have suggestions of those who might be really good at communications, although I'm the chair, I'm not a communications person at my job at all. It's kind of a new thing for me. But if you do know of those who would be willing to serve or would be a good fit for communications or commission, I would love to hear so we can invite them to join us.
If we have, just as a review, if we have folks who we think would be good to serve on any of our subcommittees, do we have to bring their names to the commission as a whole, or can you just work directly through the subcommittee?
I don't know that we've ever approved or talked about committee members. I think we've heard a few suggestions, but I don't think we've gone through lists of names.
Yeah, okay. So if we have suggestions for a particular subcommittee, we're able to just reach out to the subcommittees and say, why don't you include this person?
So this
So thank you, Anne Marie. And I would like to be on your committee. I am the communication for the Switch Fest. Not that I'm really very communicative, but I have tons of things to ask you. But can we take a look at that? I know you gave us a link some time back, but I've had it again, I'm sure I've lost it, or I have it someplace else. But I'm very excited. And I have some ideas about some personal profiles, so I'm really excited for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Emery, just as we move forward with this, Utah Interactive will continue to be our
go-to entities. We have additional things like Commissioner Barnett's talking about, profiles and things. They're going to walk with us in perpetuity, as far as we know, for making changes.
Yes.
And
that was the plan from the beginning. I think that the changes that we wanted to make over the last few months, as far as layout and content, not massive changes, but I think it was more than they anticipated, but it hasn't changed their commitment to help us make updates. I think their commitment was 24 hours, which to us was only time for an update. So, yeah,
great.
Okay. And going back to the architect, Bill, which I just thought they were so great, I think that you should profile or think about the women that came forward, them particularly. The field itself, yes, and what we did when we were trying to create and all that, that can be part of it, but that's a start with just those great women and how hard they worked.
That's great. Yeah. Good suggestion. And I think Senator Henderson and Estonia could connect you up with those women. Mr. Bellis.
So I looked up the code just to answer your question about the special committees and whatnot that you'd be brought before the committee. So it is the committee as a whole that appoints the members of the special committees. So it has to, the fact that the language says that suggests to me that the committee does need to, as a quorum, agree on the appointments of those members of the special committees.
I think that there are spaces on each one of these subcommittees that could be, we can make them a little more robust in terms of membership. And so maybe as chairs of each of the subcommittees, we could be looking at, and as well as members in general of the commission, if you know people who would be a strong asset for any of our subcommittees, come in our February meeting and let's have a discussion and sort of approve those folks to sit on the subcommittees. I think that would be, that'd be helpful. Thank you for looking that up. Yeah. All right. Thank you to the subcommittee for your work, and we'll look forward to seeing you on, yes, Mr. Wallace.
This is just any other business, but the Women's Business Center where I work has actually launched a statewide initiative that I'd like to show the commission at a future time. It's exciting, and it has to do with women all over our state, so I thought you would like to hear about it.
Okay. So would that be something you'd like to present on in our February meeting?
If it fits, I don't know if there's room for it during the legislative session, but if it does, I would love to.
Okay, great. Let's think about including that. Shall we again? Any other additions? Okay, seeing none. Our next meeting will be on February 7th. Because it is during the legislative session, it probably will not be at 10 in the morning. I'm thinking like noon, perhaps, maybe 1. We'll look at our schedules once we get the legislative calendar, that middle part of January before the session starts, and we'll make a time, and Shelley will let everyone know. So thank you very much for being here, and as well as our audience members, and we will see everyone in February. Thank you, and have a very Merry Christmas 3 weeks from 2 days ago.